How lucky we are to live in this time, the first moment in human history when we are, in fact, visiting other worlds. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello and welcome to the premiere of Western Worlds, the newest AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and each week you can look forward to a new conversation in planetary science and exploration from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration, CPSX, located right here at the beautiful Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. The quote we started with tonight is from Carl Sagan's Cosmos series. It's a fitting, then, that our background music tonight is Alpha by Vangelis, the same music that plays as the evolution of life unfolds in the Cosmos episode, One Voice in the Cosmic Fugue. Since this is our first show, let me tell you a little bit about how Western Worlds will work. Each half-hour show will feature an interview with someone notable from our field. That could be a planetary scientist working on a space mission, an engineer developing a new exploration technology, or an educator sharing the wonders of our solar system with you, the public. We hope that you will find these interviews fascinating. I know we will. In fact, we've set aside the last few minutes of every show to talk about them amongst ourselves. I'm particularly looking forward to that part because here at CPSX, we've got all kinds of researchers, planetary geologists, astrobiologists, aerospace engineers, atmospheric physicists and astronomers, just to name a few. Because of that variety of specialization, each of our talented co-hosts brings something different to that roundtable discussion. I'm excited. This is going to be fun, and I'd like to invite you along for the ride. Won't you join us as we explore Western worlds? Without further ado, let me introduce our first guest. Tonight, we start things off with a bang as one of our co-hosts, Raymond Francis, sits down with Dr. Gordon Ozinski, a world-renowned expert on impact cratering and the acting head of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration, right here in London.
So, good evening. I'm here in London with Dr. Gordon Ozinski.
Good evening. Thanks for having me here.
Your specialty is in impact cratering and other geologic matters. So, impact craters, first of all, where do we find these and what are they in the basic?
So, impact cratering is actually one of the most important geological processes in the solar system. We just don't think about it too much here on Earth because we don't have too many impact craters left preserved. We do actually have quite a few in Canada. You tend to find them in the places in the world with the oldest rocks. So, the Canadian Shield is a place where there are lots of impact craters preserved. And what these craters represent, essentially, are sort of cosmic scars, as people have called them, from the impact of an asteroid or a comet with the Earth any time from yesterday to a few billion years ago.
And I suppose it makes sense to be finding them in the oldest rocks since the newer processes, erosion and things, will obscure these?
Yep, exactly. Okay. And of course on Earth, 2/3 of our planet is ocean. Not only that, but the ocean crust is only a couple of 100 million years old. And so we have a very active geological planet. We have plate tectonics and volcanism that just continually destroys these impact craters. But then when we look at the Moon or Mars or other planets that retain portions of their earliest crust, we see that these are the dominant geological landform.
Right, and so I think probably the people listening have seen these in images from Mars and the Moon that cover the surface of these other planets, but it's not something that we see so much here, and it's probably a fair bet to imagine that most of our listeners haven't actually seen one of these up close. But your research has taken you to some of these.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what do you see when you're standing at an impact crater? What does it look like?
Well, this is where it gets a little difficult. This is why I think the scientific community took quite a long time to accept that the Earth actually gets struck by asteroids and comets. And so if we start at the small end, people may be familiar familiar with Meteor Crater or Barringer Crater in Arizona. It's fairly close to the Grand Canyon, and there's a nice museum there. That looks like a crater. It's about 1,200 meters across. You walk up to the rim, and then you peer into this literally big hole in the ground about 200 meters deep. And so you really do get the impression that something big happened there. In that case, only about 50,000 years ago. Now, what happens, though, when craters form is that the bigger the crater is, it starts to collapse inwards. And so these larger craters that we call complex craters, they tend to be very shallow. You might be stood in the middle of one, and you often will not even realize it. Sudbury is a prime example. If anyone's been to Sudbury, you can just stand in the city of Sudbury, and you're in the middle of one of the world's biggest impact craters. But because it's so old, it's been eroded, and it's so big, you really don't get the impression that you're stood inside one.
So that Sudbury crater is about 600 kilometers north of us here in London. How big is that crater?
It's a little difficult to estimate because it is so old. It formed about 2 billion years ago, and so it's suffered a lot of erosion, glaciation, it's been deformed. But we estimate about 200 kilometers in diameter, so it's fairly substantial in size.
And I gather that actually diameter is an interesting question when you're talking about craters. In the case of a structure like Sudbury, when you give a measure like that, what exactly do you mean? From where to where are you?
That's a point of hot debate in the impact community. It's a lot easier when you're looking at craters on places like the Moon and Mars, where we usually define the rim as the topographic highest point. And so just like Meteor Crater, you see this profile where the rim is uplifted relative to the surrounding terrain. The problem is on Earth, that's usually the first thing that gets eroded. So you have a very flat profile. So it does become a bit subjective in saying how big something is. So we tend to use the apparent crater diameter when we're talking about structures here on Earth.
I suppose that makes sense. And particularly in the case of Sudbury, where it's not even round anymore after so many years of other effects.
Yeah, I mean, Sudbury is a bit of an enigma because if you look at it from space, it's egg-shaped. And it's been squashed and deformed by essentially a mountain-building event a few hundred million years ago.
The crater itself being how old?
1.85 billion, to be exact.
Which is a long time in geological terms. So then, I mean, we find craters all over the planet, not all of them from impacts, though. How do you recognize an impact crater as opposed to something that might be formed by a volcano or something else?
Yep, no, you're quite correct. There are a lot of volcanic craters around the world, and probably, if you counted them up, more than actual meteorite impact craters. Some of them can look very similar, in particular these so-called Mar craters that are the result of interaction between lava and water. You tend to get quite a flat crater, and again, you're not on a summit of a volcano, and so they can look quite similar. There's only one accepted way that you can tell if something's a meteorite impact crater or not, and that is by finding certain key criteria in the rocks, and we call those shock metamorphic effects.
What are these effects?
Shock metamorphic effects are essentially features that are formed in the rocks by the meteorite impact, and the key thing is that they need high temperature and pressure. You don't form them in any other geological setting. You don't form them in volcanic eruptions, mountain building events, or anything else. And interestingly, most of these effects have been formed in nuclear tests during the 1960s and 70s, and again, that's because you need, usually it's the high pressure. High temperature affects it a little bit, but it's all about high pressure.
So you actually see these in the craters formed by these nuclear bomb tests.
Yeah, which is really quite interesting.
Yeah, I suppose this speaks to the amount of energy that's available when you have a meteorite impact.
Well, there's a few different types of these shock metamorphic effects. Most of them are microscopic. You actually will need a microscope to see them. Mm-hmm. And so that involves bringing a rock home from this potential crater, making a very thin section of it, and looking at under the microscope. There is one feature, however, that you can see with your naked eye, and that's something we call shatter cones.
What are these?
What these are essentially conical fractures, so cone-shaped fractures in the rock. Sometimes you can see complete cones, look like a kind of a traffic cone, the orange and white things. You see them collected together, usually pointing in roughly the same direction, and you see these distinctive lines on the surface of the cone. And again, the only place we've ever seen them is in meteorite impact craters or in these nuclear tests.
Why would you find these in these high-pressure shock events? What is it that makes that shatter cone happen?
Shock is the key. When an impact crater forms, it's actually not being excavated by the projectile. People used to think that 100 years ago, but what actually happens is that the projectile, which could be an asteroid or a comet, hits the surface of the planet, it burrows in just a little bit, and then essentially it stops, and at that point a shockwave radiates out. And it's the shockwave that is really high pressure and of short duration that not only excavates the crater, but also creates these shock metamorphic effects. And so we're talking about pressures that we just don't have on the surface of the Earth, sometimes higher than pressure at the center of the Earth, too.
So it's not the mass of the impactor itself that's mechanically pushing the rock away?
No, it's this shockwave that radiates out. It's basically like a very high-energy seismic wave that you would get from an earthquake.
Then if it's a shockwave that's radiating out, I suppose then the crater that can be produced would be rather larger than the impactor?
Yes, so this is a very interesting thing too. It's hard to scale because, of course, you can change a lot of input parameters.
Mm-hmm. Like the speed of the projectile.
Exactly, right? The speed, the density of the projectile. Mm-hmm. So you could have a small, dense projectile coming in, and the energy would be the same as a slow, kind of big asteroid. But in terms of energy, roughly speaking, it scales about 1 to 10 or 1 to 20. So if you have a 1 kilometer projectile, you'll get a transient initial crater about 10 kilometers across. And then when that collapses, it's about double that again, so about 20 kilometers across.
That's a big mess for a small rock.
Exactly.
So these shock effects, are they limited to the crater itself, only inside, or where do you find effects of the impact event?
They're most common in the crater, in the rocks in the interior of the crater. But of course, one distinctive thing about impact events is that you throw a lot of material outside the crater, and we call that the ejecta. And so that can be within a few tens of kilometers of the crater. But for large impact events, Sudbury is a good example, that would have distributed material all around the globe. You could find shocked quartz, for example, on the other side of the planet from these big impact events.
So that stuff is distributed sort of through the air. It flies away from the impact site.
Essentially, some of it leaves the atmosphere and then will just gently settle down, sometimes all around the world.
So, I mean, if you can distribute material globally, is it possible even to have stuff that's leaving the planet?
Absolutely. If you actually think about it, what this impact process is how you form and launch meteorites. We actually have meteorites from the Moon, Mars, and asteroids on Earth, and they were ejected by impact events on those planets. And so, yes, absolutely, a portion of the material you throw up can get ejected out of the Earth's atmosphere in this case. I don't know if you're going with this question, but there should be meteorites from the Earth on the Moon and potentially even Mars.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Particularly to think, I have this very destructive event that you've compared to a nuclear bomb test, and yet rocks are surviving to be found elsewhere on other planets.
Yeah.
So you talk about this ejecta, and you have a paper recently in which you propose that this ejecta isn't just a big mess of material, but that it actually forms in layers.
Yes.
Can you tell us about this layered ejecta?
Yeah, so this has been ongoing for a few years now, actually back to my PhD. And essentially, if you pick up a textbook on impact craters, you'll see kind of one stage of ejecta formation that happens very early on as the crater is getting formed. Basically, people 20, 30 years ago had recognized that in some instances you see multiple layers of ejecta. It's very common on Mars. You actually get these so-called rampart, they used to call them splosh craters, where it looks like essentially they were mud flows, very fluid-like ejecta patterns, and often, again, one layer on top of another, sometimes on top of another. Now, that was interesting, but then we started looking at impact craters on the Moon, and we also started to see a similar thing. Different kinds of textures and patterns, but basically one layer that is patchy overlying a more continuous layer of ejecta.
So is that something you've also seen in terrestrial craters?
And I was just going to say that. Yeah. And so one of the craters where I did my PhD is the Ries crater in Germany. And that's one of the best preserved craters. And there you see these two layers of ejecta again. And so it was just putting together all of these observations and thinking about how you actually do this. Because when you go to this crater on Earth, which is really the only way to ground truth craters and processes on other bodies, you see that the two layers are very distinctive. The material from one comes from deeper than the other. There's more molten material in one layer than the other. And so we basically had to piece all of this together and come up with a new model for injector and placement that is essentially a multi-stage process.
So you talk about ground-truthing the ideas of crater formation on other bodies. How many craters do we have to reference on Earth?
So the number goes up a few each year. I think currently we're at about 180.
Those are new formations or?
No, so newly discovered.
Okay, very good.
Yeah. So there's about 180 craters. Now, out of those, many of them are eroded. Quite a few are buried. So really not accessible to going and studying and doing geology on. And so there's maybe a third of those are places where you could go and do some detailed studies.
And how similar would they be to the craters we find in other bodies?
Cratering is one of these processes that really is the same on any planetary body. Gravity and certain different other factors will influence the outcomes a little bit, but the overall process is essentially the same. Now, the rocks are different on Earth than they are on the Moon, at least in some instances, but overall they would look the same. Again, the big thing on Earth is that it's very rare to find an absolutely pristine, fresh crater. And so we're usually looking at some eroded remnant of the crater. Whereas on other planets, especially the Moon, you're looking at the pristine surface.
So your research group has spent some time using these craters as analogs for the sites that we would find on the Moon or Mars. You had a group that was in Sudbury this year and also up in the Kamistastin crater in Labrador.
Yes.
What were they doing up there?
So both these trips were looking at these impact craters as analog sites, and as you mentioned, for the Moon in this instance. And so this was a series of analog missions. So we were basically simulating a sample return mission to the Moon. To do that, we wanted it to be in a scientifically interesting and applicable site. When you look up at the Moon, even on a clear night, you can see impact craters all over the surface. And so we chose impact craters, also because we have a lot to choose from in Canada. And the Sudbury's was one of the sites, and then Mistastin and Labrador is interesting because it is actually one of only two craters where you do see rocks that we see on the Moon.
Which sort of rocks are these?
When you look up at the Moon, you see two basically different types of rocks. The dark black patches are essentially lavas, and the white is a rock type called anorthosite.
All right.
And so it just so happens that this crater in Labrador, and there's one other one in Quebec, has a large amount of anorthosite. And so it makes it a very good analog scientifically as well as kind of environmentally as well.
So you're talking about analog missions. What kinds of things were you doing to simulate a space mission?
You can take several different approaches to analog missions. If you had millions and millions of dollars, you could probably run a fully realistic simulated mission that has spacesuits and all of the technology that you'd probably actually take to the Moon. In this instance, we were really focused more on the science and the operations. So learning about how to do mission control operations, how to direct people in the field. We were also interested in instrument development and the types of instruments that we would send. We essentially had humans in the field acting as astronauts, and then the other big change is that we had a robot working with the University of Toronto group. And so this is something that wasn't done during Apollo. The astronauts were just up there on their own with very basic minimal tools. And so we kind of basically have to learn again how to do these surface operations, especially with robots and with kind of modern day technologies.
And did you get some interesting results from working together astronauts and robots? Is that something that led to some news?
Absolutely. And we're kind of in the process of writing a lot of these results up right now. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I think a lot of people have or had written off the use of robots in the field helping astronauts. One of the interesting things we did, though, was to turn that around and actually have the astronaut help the robot to learn certain paths in the field. And then essentially we could leave the robot to follow those paths and those routes on its own, even after the astronauts left for a real mission, potentially for months. And so just by directing the robot a little bit while the astronauts were there, you potentially set yourself up for doing science for the next few months. And so that was a really interesting thing.
And that's a new strategy that I think hasn't been employed yet.
Yeah, no, it hasn't been employed in any active space missions, so we're quite excited by that. And again, that's through this collaboration with Dr. Tim Barfoot at the University of Toronto.
Maybe we'll have to talk to him about that at some
Absolutely.
Point.
Absolutely, yes.
You know, you're doing all of this work in operations and in developing robotic technologies and techniques. Did you manage to get some scientific use out of the sites as well?
Absolutely. Mistastin in particular, one of the unique features about this site is that it really hasn't been studied much. Sudbury, of course, has had geologists working there for 100 years.
But Mistastin is very remote.
Exactly, yeah. And it's actually like a lot of the Canadian craters where they were discovered maybe in the 1960s and 70s. They were visited once and then really not touched on again. So Mistastin did have a bit of work done by a group from Memorial about 2 or 3 years ago, but it's still a very understudied crater. And so we've had several graduate students and undergraduate students working on this crater now. And we have some really interesting, exciting findings.
And of course, part of the challenge being that it's almost 400 kilometers north of Goose Bay in almost the middle of nowhere. There's no road, there's no airport to get there.
Yeah.
So, but you've had a group up there almost every year for for 6 or 7 years now?
4 years now.
4 years?
Yeah.
Okay. So we talked about the emplacement of material in ejecta and the shock effects on the rock as the crater is formed.
Mm-hmm.
But afterwards, what kind of effects and evolution can you see in the crater afterwards? What things can be triggered by having an impact come in?
So this is one of the other aspects of my work. For a long time, or if I ask the listeners, maybe when you think of an impact crater, you think of the wiping out of the dinosaurs and Deep Impact movies, Armageddon, where it's a very destructive event. And that's definitely the case. But what my group has been doing over the last few years, too, is looking at these craters after they form, and we're finding lots of evidence that, for microbial life at least, these represent really protective niches and oases where life could recolonize after they were formed. The single biggest thing there is that impact craters generate so-called hydrothermal systems.
How does that happen?
And so all you need for a hydrothermal system is heat plus water. And if the prime examples today are places like Yellowstone National Park, Iceland, New Zealand, where you have hot springs and geysers bubbling away. And all of those are generated by having volcanic heat sources beneath those areas. So the hot rocks, you have water interacting with them. The water heats up, rises to the surface, and comes out in these geysers and these hot springs.
So when you form an impact, you obviously melt a lot of material.
Yep.
How long can that rock stay hot to power a hydrothermal system?
It scales almost exponentially with crater size. And so this crater I've been working up in Nunavut, it's 23 kilometers across, and there the hydrothermal system probably lasted for maybe 20, 30,000 years. But people have then worked on the Sudbury hydrothermal system and have dated that system as lasting probably more like 1 million years.
1 million years?
Yes.
Of hydrothermal heat from a single impact?
Yeah. And so one then needs to think about, well, on the early histories of planets, we had craters 1,000, 2,000 kilometers across. And then one has to wonder how long those hydrothermal systems would have lasted.
That is interesting, particularly on Mars, where you see very large impacts. On the Moon, maybe there wasn't water, but you have impacts thousands of kilometers across.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and the reason why this is also interesting, of course, is if you do go to these hydrothermal sites on Earth, they're basically teeming with life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's not the type of you and I in terms of life or even plants and animals, but it's microbial life. And you look into these springs and you see these orange and pink and green mats. And essentially, they're cyanobacteria, and they're thriving in these hot environments. And many people think that life on Earth actually originated in such hydrothermal systems. So this is an exciting thing, I think, where not only can you generate them from volcanic activity, but also impact craters. And as you said, on Mars is interesting, of course, because we do know there was water and still is water in the frozen form. And so potentially many of these impact craters generated hydrothermal systems.
And even in the more recent Martian craters, we're finding these ejecta deposits that are acting as mud flows as if there's water content in the material.
Yep, exactly.
Do you think it's possible to still form hydrothermal systems on Mars with new impacts?
Yeah. I mean, theoretically, it's totally possible. It would need to be kind of a few kilometers or more across, a fair-sized crater, but if we had one forming today on Mars, it should be able to generate such a system.
That's a really interesting contrast, how you talk about this destructive force that can make a hole in the ground 100 kilometers wide, that can shock rocks like nothing else, and yet here you're creating this oasis for bacteria, a warm, nutrient-rich environment. Speaking of large craters and destruction, some of your proposals, including the Analog Project, use the South Pole Aitken Basin on the Moon as a notional target.
Yes.
Why is this impact particularly interesting?
Okay, so the South Pole Aitken Basin is one of the largest impact craters in the solar system, easily 2,000 kilometers across, if not more. It's actually, its size is hard to estimate, goes back to our early discussion. But it's essentially one of the oldest and biggest craters in the solar system. And so why this crater is interesting is that the solar system formed, we know, at about 4.5 billion years ago. When we brought back the Apollo samples from the Moon, there seemed to be a cluster of ages at around 3.8 to 4 billion years. And they really weren't finding any rocks that were older than that, or they were very scarce. And so this led to many to come up with this hypothesis called the late heavy bombardment, or the lunar cataclysm.
Okay, so what's this?
So essentially, the theory goes, you had formation of the solar system 4.5 billion years ago, then there was 500 million years, so 500 million years, which is considerable length of time, actually.
Considering the age of the solar system at that point.
Exactly. And then there was a spike in, essentially, impact craters in the inner solar system where something happened to cause all of these asteroids and comets to strike the moon and also the Earth. And why this is interesting for Earth is that we know that life originated on Earth during this time frame, which kind of makes you wonder why it did and how it did, if this was really a hellish environment on early Earth, as the Hadean is called, mm-hmm. this period of early Earth.
Particularly in the light of impact craters as habitats for life.
Exactly, yeah. So it's quite interesting. And so why South Pole Aitken Basin plays such a big role is that, essentially, one theory has just lots of impacts when the solar system formed, and it tailed off gradually. And then this late heavy bombardment theory has a spike at about 3.84 billion years. And so if you were to date the largest, oldest basin, it would help to tie down that cratering record. By dating that basin, we can potentially solve this question. For example, if one were to date the South Pole Aitken Basin, and its age is about 4 billion years, I think most people would agree that, okay, this late heavy bombardment occurred. Of course, if we date it in its 4.5 billion years, this theory will still probably bubble along and be alive for a bit longer yet.
Right, okay.
But it really, because it's so old and is the biggest one, it really will tie down kind of what happened in that first few hundred million years of the solar system.
That's interesting then, if we can, you know, learn about the history of the solar system by seeing the record that may be preserved in South Pole Aitken.
Mm-hmm. And the moon is really the only place to do this, and it's, I think, one of the most compelling reasons to go back to the moon. We generally think it's been there, seen it, done it, planetary body. But there's a lot left to learn. And again, for learning about the Earth and the environment on Earth, it's really critical because we don't have any rocks older than about just over 4 billion years old. And so we have to go to the moon where those really early rocks are preserved.
Well, that is an interesting approach, and certainly perhaps the only way we can do it, to learn some of these things about the oldest parts of the solar system and about our own world. In any case, it's interesting research, and I hope we can probably talk to you again about the next steps that you take on this.
Sounds good.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
Yeah.
You're listening to Western Worlds here on Astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
There was a presentation at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference last year in Texas about a suspected new discovery of an impact crater off the coast of Quebec, which is in the floor of the Gulf of St. Lawrence, off of Sept Îles. And here, it's underwater, it's buried by tens of meters of seawater, but they suspect there's a crater there, based on the shape and dragging up one piece of breccia from the seafloor. But from the layout of the thing, the hypothesis is that, and the timing, the apparent age, the hypothesis is that this actually would have struck during the last glaciation, and it probably would have gone through a kilometer or two of ice to get to the rock. Now, this was, of course, you know, one abstract, and I think it's the first time this crater has ever been presented publicly, so I'm sure there will be decades of back and forth on this. But it's an interesting thought to actually burrow right through the ice.
There's something else that struck me in Oz's interview. He talks about how, for a very long time, these things were not thought to result from impacts. These craters were thought to be volcanic or to have some other origin. Mm-hmm. And now we almost have the opposite problem, that every circular hole in the ground is, it's another crater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then you have to go there and prove it, which I guess Oz has done a couple of times with these suggested new craters. But as he says, the shock is the key, right? If you don't have the shock effect, it's very hard to say that it was an impact crater.
Right, which is why I find it interesting that they mm-hmm. brought back one piece of rock and said,
mm-hmm.
oh, this must be from a crater, because you can find that type of rock in various places.
It'd be zero pieces of rock.
That's right. Well, the thing is, so, you know, you talk about a continent-scale glaciation. I mean, those glaciers can pull rocks around and drag them some distance, right?
Right.
So you found one piece of breccia with a few weeks of dredging.
It's true. And from the climate point of view, getting strange rocks in that area, not too difficult a thing at the end of the last glaciation.
Exactly. So not to knock on this discovery. I mean, maybe there's a real thing there, and I think it'll be a while before we can be sure. But certainly an interesting idea of having rocks come right through ice sheets. So I'm particularly also interested in Oz's work using these impact craters as analogs for sites that we would find on the Moon, Mars, and elsewhere, both scientifically and for staging simulated space missions. It's certainly something that we've been doing here at Western, but we're not the only group who does that kind of thing.
That's true, and down in the United States, it's done in a much bigger way with groups like Desert Rats, for instance.
Mm-hmm. The analog project that we ran here at Western, though, was actually particularly useful for achieving some outreach. Even in Mistassin, we had the member of Parliament come through and talk to me while I was standing in the mud there.
But didn't they, when they went to Sudbury, did they not do...
Yeah.
They actually outreach.
We did go and...
Oh, afterwards,
yeah,
yes.
We did go to talk at Science North. And...
Yeah. I think one of the reasons why it's a great thing in terms of outreach is, especially if you're going to somewhere like Sudbury, mm-hmm. You have a community that's right there. So you can go do your analog mission, and then you can go to the community and say, hey, this is what we're doing, this is why it's important, this is why you should be interested, mm-hmm. and they get a lot out of it in that way. Sometimes, you know, if you're going up north, in the far north, mm-hmm. Obviously to Devon Island and stuff like that, it's really cool and much more like Mars up there than it is in Sudbury,
yeah.
But it's also not as great for outreach in terms of connecting with the community. So there are benefits to doing both, yeah. I think.
Although we were fortunate in Labrador at the Kamistastin site, mm-hmm. The local community was very interested to connect with these researchers who were coming in, and you know, they're very connected to the land in terms of hunting and the somewhat mobile lifestyle. And to have outsiders very interested in the particulars of their land as well,
mm-hmm.
And seeing a value in it. Was something that was very useful for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to kind of get both sides of the story, right? You mm-hmm. have the science side, but you can also get from their culture and their community mm-hmm. why that land is important for them and why it might be sacred to their culture.
Well, in fact, I spoke with one of the members of the Innu community up there who was saying that the Kamistastin site, where the crater is, has for centuries been a focus of transport and hunting and fishing. Because unlike everywhere else in Labrador, the rivers flow to the sea. And here, the rivers flow inward to the lake because of the macro scale effects of the crater.
Okay,
so there's a lake here with fish in it, and it happens to be an easy place for the caribou to pass through. So millions of years after the crater comes through, people are and animals are still benefiting from this.
Hmm.
It's an interesting aspect of the outreach to explain to people. So here's why the land is this way. And this land that has influenced the way that your culture and your community and your economy have developed, we can tell you this is the event in the past.
Mm-hmm.
It's also kind of interesting that a lot of the traditional metal tools from the north before the Europeans showed up,
mm-hmm.
those are all made with meteoritic iron.
Are they? Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about making things with what comes from meteorites. I mean, Sudbury is a mining community for 120 years now, and it's the only reason there are mines there is because they're digging up the melt sheet from the impact crater.
Exactly. It's that hydrothermal system that concentrates things.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that it was big enough and molten for long enough, Oz was talking about a hydrothermal system of 1 million years, it was molten for a significant fraction of that, long enough that it can actually differentiate and sort itself by density and chemical compatibility. And so the nickel and the copper all end up in one place at the bottom of the melt sheet. So it's all concentrated, and it's economically sensible to recover it.
Exactly. And if you look around the world for similar sites for mining, you tend to find sites that are either impacts or volcanic.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever you have that water that cycles through, because you get a cycle where you have hot water at the bottom, it dissolves materials, and then it comes up to the top, those materials come out of solution, you get these really enriched veins. And veins is exactly the right word for it.
It's nice that you guys are giving this explanation, because a lot of times when I go to schools, they think that the mining is being done there because an asteroid had landed there, and they're actually mining what's left over from the asteroid.
Yeah.
So it's this kind of big misconception that we really need to fix, and try to tell them that no, it's actually excavating what's on Earth and doing, like you said, the differentiation and the melting and all this process going on. It's not the asteroid that's landed. We're not mining that.
Yeah, because whatever that impactor was made of, as Oz says, there's not much left of it.
Right.
But the effects are much larger. You know, that thing may have been 9 kilometers across, but the crater is 200. And so, you know, here we have this big basket of metal resources, still probably 100 years of mining left in that site.
that's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. A roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Raymond Francis, Alyssa Gilbert, and John Moores. Our editors were John Moores and Michael Forster. And, as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online. The discussion doesn't need to end here. Or you can learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, www.cpsx.uwo.ca/Western Worlds. Or follow us on Twitter at WWAFM. Or you can like our Facebook account, Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. Next week, we'll have Paul Delaney on the show right after a brand new episode of his York Universe. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on Astronomy.fm.